If you look at my, I guess, the Twitter feeds about new papers, I cannot keep up.
Yeah.
It seems to me is like, at the end of the day, how these architectures, how fragile, how brittle they can be. Very small changes that for a human will be no intended affected. But if innovation occurs at the moment of ingesting data and detecting this type of data points that are anomalous, that will be a huge win.
So, hello and welcome everyone to whoever's listening to this particular podcast. Today we have with us Alberto Santamaria Pang. Alberto is a principal applied data scientist at Microsoft, and he did his PhD in computer science from University of Houston. And he has a long experience and a career in research and development on various AI projects, including but not limited to medical imaging and deep learning. Prior to Microsoft, he was a principal scientist at GE Research, and he has led many research projects in industry and also government-funded projects, few of which we'll be discussing today. So, Alberto, welcome to the podcast, and it's finally nice to have you on the show.
Thank you, Jake. A pleasure to be in the podcast, and thanks for the invite.
Yeah. All right. To get started, I think for people who might not know you, can you tell us a bit about your background? So I think you have a long career in industry, but what was your background before you started into this industry? And how did the process look like from being a new grad employee at some company to now being a principal scientist?
Yeah, thank you for the question. And perhaps I'll take one step back and maybe kind of provide some ideas about my background, starting from my undergraduate. Yeah. So I did my undergraduate in Mexico. I received my degree in pure mathematics. And then from that point, I wanted to leverage, I guess, mathematical principles in applied sciences, and in particular, computer science. That was in my career path I wanted to follow. And along those lines, the area that was of interest for me was medical, biomedical imaging. But I guess kind of point here is that while focusing on a theoretical, career path, mathematics, there is a leap of faith in computer science. What the benefit of doing that is, if we understand it, kind of the mathematical principles, theoretical formulations, that is allowing or is kind of giving more flexibility in going deeper in some areas. So my path started in basically mathematics, Mexico. I went to computer science. I was interested in medical, had the opportunity in working in biomedical imaging projects. From there, I was looking for a research-based, I guess, roles. And I found one in General Electric very interesting. And I was very fortunate in working on projects related on research and development that span different areas in the industry, going from healthcare to aviations, inspections, and others. And then I spent about 12 years of my tenure in GE Research and developing analytics algorithms applied to different areas. And then recently just joined Microsoft about 1 year and a half. Focus is to understand principles of methods, techniques applied to imaging or healthcare in the context of scalability for cloud-based solutions. So in that sense, I guess one of my main roles in Microsoft as a principal applied research scientist is to be to act as an ANT operator between research groups and product teams, where we can create an instance of a new technology that will go all the way from, design, development, all the way to production and maintenance.
I see. Interesting. And I think you did mention about your interest in medical imaging. Was there like a particular experience or instance that made you interested specifically for medical imaging? Like, I think you have a background in mathematics and computer science, which is fairly engineering based. Like, what was that particular experience that made you very intrigued about applications to medical imaging?
Thank you for asking, Jay. So it's a kind of a personal story to that. I was always interested in medical. Incidentally, when I see blood, I guess I'm not very receptive to it. But I guess one of my main points in my personal experience was I had a fracture of a bone. I ended up in an ER heart surgery. And at that point in my life, I realized that technology, computer science and mathematics can actually do help. Help providers and help people in general. So yet at that point in time of my, I guess, personal life, that's where I decided I wanted to pursue that career path. That was by the end of my my undergraduate studies. Mm-hmm. But I guess that kind of set the point.
Interesting. Yeah, that's very nice to know. Like, I think a lot of people I know are like getting into this field by this particular inception. So I think it's wonderful to have like a personal motivation in this particular field. Yeah. And talking more, like this is one thing. This is like a personal curiosity also. Like, I see, like at least for research projects, I have seen this title, principal scientist. It could be either, like, I think in your case, you're an applied data scientist, but the broad definition of principal scientist revolves a lot around people who are involved in research. So can you tell more about like this title itself? Like, how does this title fit into the whole food chain of people who are involved from, I don't know, the most highest people who think about these projects versus relating to all the software engineers that are on the bottom of the food chain, like basically who implement these stuff? And what does this role look like, and how does it fit into the project's life cycle, at least in research?
Yeah, thank you for asking. Yeah, so I guess there is kind of overall concept or picture about a principal scientist, and then there might be different roles or specializations. I guess one of the main, at the broader level, one of the main roles is about collaboration and innovations, collaborating with different teams internally and externally, research from product teams, program managers, stakeholders, defining ideas, shaping ideas, also talking to business units and suggesting best practices or what might be kind of new product generations in the business as far as kind of new products and services. So I guess it's, there are different mechanisms in how a principal scientist this might fit in different type of organizations, but generally speaking, that's one of the main roles in my mind, I guess, at the high level.
Right. And does it, like, how does your routine look like? So, like, you mentioned a lot of things. There are definitely like more things that we can imagine about these projects that you just mentioned, but I think each of them take time. So what does your ideal routine look like? So if you are starting on a project that's completely new, what are the major things that you will be doing, and what, like, basically what are the deliverables for a principal scientist? Because I have seen like how I report to a principal scientist, but I don't know what does the deliverable of a principal scientist look like that he or she reports to their manager or whatever the title is.
Yes, so I guess the deliverable wise depends on the specific program. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, it's all about impact. Yeah. Having impact in the product, having impact in the customers, and in the technology as well. So I guess deliverables are, maybe I will try to resume in this one, moving products from new technologies, providing technical guidance, domain knowledge, and pushing the state of the art to improve a specific product or service. Mm-hmm. So that is, at the end of the day, I guess, one major trend. And there are different ways in how this is actually achieved, depending on the program. So there are programs that they require a very hands-on, approach. So expectation-wise is that the principal scientist will also be coding, will be coding along the lines of developers or researchers. There might be some other programs that are perhaps not well-defined or not defined at all. So expectations are that a program will be defined in the along the lines of asking the question, what will be the minimum requirements for setting an idea? Will that be a meaningful and measurable milestone? Will that provide a baseline for subsequent programs? Or are there other type of question is, what are the technologies within organizations that are usable and potentially impactful? So I guess depending of the different tasks or specific goals, there are different ways on how this can be achievable. But at the end of the day is, how can we impact products and services?
I see. Interesting. And One question, like specifically, I think again, this would vary from teams to team, but is it like what drives these particular projects? Is there often a curiosity for like theoretical exploration in terms of research, or is it specifically only to maximize or optimize a particular business need? Like what drives a particular project? Would the team be at all interested in like just for the sake of exploration, right? Like you figure out a theoretical problem saying that, oh, hey, I just want to see how these particular functions would optimize using a deep learning. Like how do I optimize for a better loss function or something? Like something I think people in academia work for. But is there, could there be a possibility where people in industry or people who lead these projects would be interested in certain kind of deliverables like these?
Yeah, and I would think is effectively a mix of both. And there are different ways of how this can be initiated. This can be initiated about how can we improve a specific service or product. Mm-hmm. And that will set a roadmap, a strategy, how we can execute and push the state of the art along those lines. There might be other, ways or roads in where we say, well, we want, we have an ideas about pushing the state of the art. About a new technology, we know we have demonstrated feasibility on that. How will this help a specific product, or what will be the roadmap for it to be a product? So I guess this, at the end of the day, is a blend between these two components. It might be initiated either by one or the other.
Right. And I think, a lot of people would also want to know is these roles don't come with like a technical guidebook, right? Like, I think even when we do PhD, like I'm doing my PhD and you also did your PhD some time back, these kind of definitions and defining these KPIs and all those things for research projects, they don't really come. Like, I think there's no course where you can do that teaches you, okay, you will be doing these things. So what was the process for you? Like how did you end up learning these things that are an addition to, as in doing PhD, right? Like in PhD, we already know like how we are supposed to work, how we are supposed to present our results, talk about it, publish those, and like talk more about it. But how did you learn these subtle characteristics of a particular person who is working in the industry that has other obligations?
Yeah, no, that's a very, very good point. Thank you for asking that. So I guess maybe to backtrack a tiny bit. So yeah, most of these problems, if not all, they are not well-defined and they have never done before. So in that sense, there is no specific approach that we might try as a template. Mm-hmm. I guess perhaps kind of the closest that we can rely is on the analogies to previous previous problems, and understanding what is, generally speaking, the state of the art today. And I guess what is that is kind of one road map along the approach to this type of problems. Second is on the collaboration. So mm-hmm. And understanding what other people have worked on similar problems, how can I can leverage, I guess, my personal experience, but also I can leverage the experience and the technical competence of my entire team and the teams that are, I guess, have the same technologies. So these two components, I guess, these two main axes might be a path in how we can approach these type of problems. And many times it's about trying an idea, failing quickly, understanding and improving, getting feedback from the customer, a collaborator, and improving, I guess, on an iteration basis. So that is a process. It's not like a one-shot specific, trial.
Yeah, definitely. I agree to that. And just to add on to that particular thing is like I did my intern at Amazon this summer, and I learned a lot of things in the sense that I was working on a project that was like in the works for many years. And when I learned about, like, I think they have these documents where they document everything that they tried. And it was only, I think, third week or something when I learned what the other things people have tried. And there were so many things that like teams worked on, and I think more than 15 people worked on it. and things that didn't work or maybe didn't work up to the expectations. And then when I learned, like, okay, most of these times industry don't publish these things, but they are working on so many things. And like you said, like you iterate over these things, like you try out things that don't work, you take a step back and keep on doing. So exactly. Yeah, but from the outside, it always looks like the industry worked on this. They had immense amount of people who worked on it, resources, and bam, you have a very good result. So yeah, I completely second that. But you also have been, like, in your experience, you have been working as a principal investigator on several government-funded projects, like I think DARPA that we were talking about last time. And so I'll talk about these projects also in detail, but how does these two roles differ? So you have been a principal investigator. I know my professor is a principal investigator, so I kind of know what she works, but still I won't say I know 100% of what she works on. But how does these two roles differ? So being a principal scientist versus a principal investigator, what are the mindset switches that you might have to do? Like switch you back to a principal investigator, what are the things that you will immediately change in yourself that, hey, oh, I'm not a principal scientist anymore, I can't do that, I have to do this or something like that?
Yes, no, thank you for asking. So I believe there is significant overlap between these two. Mm-hmm. The main one, I will say, is a passion about the technology. Really caring and believing in the technology and having the technical competence in executing. In my mind, kind of the most meaningful similarities are having an idea from the ground, establishing what idea, what technology might actually be useful for, understanding what are the limitations, what is might be viable in the short term, what are the technical gaps, what are the risks, and then having a strategy execution on initial use cases. From there, I guess DARPA is extremely rigorous in setting metrics, technical, I guess, understanding the technical approach, and what might be the actual risk associated to that. Mm-hmm. And perhaps something that is we should be, I guess, pretty mindful in that way, it's about the budget and resources. Mm-hmm. How can you achieve those goals with a reasonable budget and timelines? So I guess from the tactical perspective, is very similar. From the strategic perspective, I see those analogies, I guess, running in parallel. Perhaps from a posterior stage or a post wise stage, in the programs that are associated to principal roles, I guess, on industry, that are very specific towards a product or a service, whereas in DARPA it might be exploratory based. It might be on the idea of pushing the state of the art. And sometimes those programs, the most successful, meaningful ones, they may have, I guess, kind of follow-ups, subsequent efforts. But I would say, just in short, the most similarities are in the strategic point of view, conceptualizing the idea, the technology, tactic-wise executions, and I guess perhaps kind of the most different one is on what happens after, or after that program. What will be the scale needed to execute it? What will be the possible customers, potential customers that we may be impacting? And then will be another question, how will we be maintaining those infrastructures after, I guess, executing and provided to customers?
Interesting. Yeah, I can imagine.
Sorry. Another point I should mention is also publications.
Yeah.
So publications is also in the scope of roles of principal scientists. From the program perspective, it's very useful to disseminate that technology. So that might be also a common point with, I guess, government-funded programs in general about career paths for principal investigators and researchers in general.
Yeah, I think I agree to that. And I think that's, as a PhD student, I really like that about like government funded projects, because most of my projects that I work on is like funded by NIA, NIH or DOD. And like before I joined as a PhD student, I used to monitor these professors' publications, and they publish like crazy, right? Like they are publishing every month or so. And I figured out like, why do they do that? What's the motivation, right? Like they have these many publications, like what does incentivize them? And when I actually started attending these DOD meetings and NIH meetings, that's when I learned like it's like a deliverable for them. Like they have to publish, and like they are at the point at the stage in life like where they don't really care about publications, but they have to publish. It's like a requirement for I think renewals for these kind of grants and everything. So yeah, I agree, like publications is like a biggest driving factor for these projects.
Yes, and I should say something that at Microsoft we cannot try to secure this also open source. So we're going to try to publish and provide, I guess, a path to fully reproduce that scientific experiment from the point of providing the access to the source code, to data sets, along with, I guess, further technical support. But I guess publications, data sets, code is pretty meaningful.
Yeah. I agree. And I think you also did mention about your collabs. So I think, and in general, like I want to learn in general and also more about your collabs. We talked offline where you said like you and your team have been collaborating with Johns Hopkins University. And I mean, that makes sense, like because it's like one of the biggest industry places that works on medical imaging and AI projects. So tell me more about these particular collabs, as in like, what are you working on and what's the collaboration if it's not confidential? Like what are these two institutes who are like really big in this space, and what are you working on? And also comment more about like how do these collaborations work in general, where industry and academia are combined? What are the expectations from both parties? Like as in what does the academia want, as in like the professor or some people, and versus what are the expectations from industry, and why do these collabs come in the first place? Like what was the need? Like why wouldn't be it completely industry or completely academia? So yeah. I know I throw a lot of questions, but feel free to take them as you want.
So thank you for asking. Yeah, certainly. So we have an active collaboration with Johns Hopkins University. In this particular case, we have very close collaborations with an imaging group for functional MRI, functional magnetic resonance imaging analysis that is led by Professor Craig Jones from the Computer Science Department. And then the main scope of this project is in helping how we can transfer or implement medical workflows that will automate some specific need in a hospital. Mm-hmm. So we are working with Dr. Harris Harder, which is the chief of neurosurgeon in the Johns Hopkins. So in that scope, we have specific medical need for which a patient is required to be on an MRI mm-hmm. and have a diagnosis, and also have a planning about a surgery. A neurosurgeon. So I guess what I'm trying to say, there are two specific needs. One is the need from the medical use case in this case, and from Microsoft, and I guess from take back from technology perspective, is very helpful in understanding what is the use case in achieving that workflow, what is kind of how technology can help in improving healthcare, day to day diagnosis, making it faster, better, and improving, accuracy, repeatability of those steps.
Right. And in terms of as in exploration, like do these kind of collabs also explore, does the end product look like a product or something, or is it like more on publications, as in like I want to explore this research problem and publish some new findings on that?
Actually, it's both. So okay. I guess there is a scope and it's on a scientific discovery, that is one. Yeah. And then the other is on the end product will be an automated process. in a hospital. But I guess kind of the main idea is to try to understand a use case, specifically in the context of a cloud-based analytics. And we want to answer the question, what will be the use case for using cloud-based technology and AI to optimize a medical workflow? What it will take to develop that tool? What it will take to deploy it? What it will take to maintain it? Understanding these use cases will be very useful. And then in the context of generalizing to more use cases that are similar.
Right. Interesting. And I think, I think you did mention about cloud-based AI applications, and that intrigued me a question, which I want to take it very slow is, first of all, I want to know, as in a lot of people, there could be like many articles that people publish and also blog articles, news article, where they hype up the idea of AI and medical imaging, right? So they say like, oh, AI is going to replace radiologists and they are going to revolutionize the medical research and all those things. But at least in my personal experience, I have been working in this field as a very newbie, but still I do feel like AI is more like a complementary thing. Like it's helping people in medical research. But I want to ask that same question to you because you have been in this field for long. Where do you see the promise of AI the most? Because a lot of people will say, hey, this is going to be great. But when we see from an outside standpoint, we don't see many applications. Like I won't be able to find many hospitals. They would say, oh, we are running the latest UNet model. Like we don't see that. Of course, publications, we get a lot of citations for sure. But since you have been collaborating with industry and academia for a long time, do you see a very strong promise that, hey, people are very looking forward to using deep learning models in their real world deployment scenarios?
Correct. Yeah. As far as the, adaptability and the impact of deep learning and analytics, as far as kind of technology, perhaps the most meaningful impact I see is there as using that as a productivity tool, not in the context of replacing a radiologist or not replacing a human expert by the final decision point, but rather is that a radiologist can improve and can improve their work, can they do it better, is easier for them. And can we democratize this, the healthcare as an industry? Can we make it more accessible and faster and better? Because not at this point about specifically about replacing radiologists or humans. And in that context, I guess in academia, publications, papers, there is growing day to day. There are new capabilities that are demonstrated every day. It's amazing. But I guess to translate that into a clinical practice as an endpoint, there is a technical gap it requires to be addressed. Up to them.
Go ahead. I was just going to ask a question, can you talk more about the technical gap, as in what are the limitations? Like, because people might not know, like, what do these challenges look like? As in, why am I not deploying a model that can classify healthy versus diseased patients using a deep learning model, even though the models that are published are like, they have great accuracies. Like, and at times they do also a comparison where they are doing a radiologic connections, right? Like qualitative results, where they will give the same MRI scans to a radiologist who has like 25 years of experience. And they will say that, hey, our machine learning or deep learning model is performing better than group of 5 radiologists. So as an outsider, it feels like, hey, deep learning model performs better. Why don't we do that? So what are the technical limitations and what are the ethical limitations in such cases that you have seen?
Yes, thank you for asking. So as far as technical limitations, this is what I call, developing AI in control environments on static data sets, whereas deploying and maintaining AI in the wild. My point is that when we when a researcher is trying a new data set, a new method, is under controlled circumstances, a limited data set. And basically, we're pushing the state of the art as far as research is concerned. But then taking that idea, that control environment, and deploying in a production environment in a hospital with day-to-day data, with new variability, coming in, multiple sources of inputs, models, they tend to break. So I guess that might be just kind of one technical gap. It's just the variability from going from proof of principle and research base to actually having this in production. Of course, it's debatable how much this can be, what is the magnitude, order of magnitude of this issue? And it also depends on the type of problem. That might be one. The second is also on the, assuming that that is achievable, there might be a second part to this, which in my mind really has to be with explainability and interpretability, that ultimately is addressing how humans, in this case radiologists, physicians, can build confidence in AI. Main point is that in many cases, the AI is essentially a black box algorithm that data is going in, parameters are estimated, and there is an output. But as a physician, as a radiologist or a biologist, someone may want to ask, why does it work? Why is it working well in these cases? Why is it failing in these cases? So I guess my point here is that providing an output, it is not sufficient for building that confidence, that trust from someone that is practicing to an analytics model that is being deployed. So there is a technical gap there that also in my mind should be addressed in how we are deploying these models in a way that are understandable, explainable by humans.
Yeah, I mean, you bring this topic and this is very interesting to me. So I have like already two or three follow-ups. And the first one is basically this topic has been explored a lot, right? Like explainable AI. But if you see in terms of very strong technical definitions, we still don't have a very nice technical definition that researchers can work on where they can define a model that is exactly explainable, because the idea of being explainable is from zero to a very analogous value. Like when do I call this particular model explainable, right? Like it's like basically, do you want a model talking to you in plain English that says, hey, this is what I'm thinking and blah, blah, blah. But it seems very unfetchable. So in your loose definitions, and feel free to take this to any definition that you want. Like if I was developing an explainable model, what would be the set of metrics that you will give me, except for like the thresholds and confidence scores that we get from a deep learning model, that will be enough for a radiologist to suffice that saying, okay, now I do understand what the model is doing. I'm just to throw it out, I think there are a few methods that do work well, and again, there are pros and cons of all these methods, like class activation maps, LIME models, and all those scenarios. But I think it really gets tricky when we are using neuroimaging data, right? Like, because there are only few methods that can help the backward propagation methods. So yeah, like in your understanding and industry applications, what would that X factor be for deep learning models to go from low confidence to high?
Yeah, thank you, Don, for asking. So in my mind, I guess there might be several, as you mentioned. But I guess what I will think about that, they are the easier to understand attention maps by radiologists. If at least an area is highlighted of a decision for that classification, a radiologist, I will understand that. At the very basic, there might be others that it might provide a subsequent output in terms of interpretable language. And in particular, I worked in technologies that are referred as emergent languages. And one of the benefits of these technologies is that the models were trained and deployed so that they were providing end classification, a segmentation, but were providing a symbolic output that is easy to read by the human, easy to interpret from a human. And that symbolic output is similar to how we, in humans, we build a sentence in the context of symbols with some precedence as far as semantic meaning. But I guess what I'm saying, semantics are super important. If that interpretability can be mapped back to the semantics, to the specific classification, the specific task from the model, and related back to the domain knowledge from the end user, that will be useful. It might be, I guess, different ways how we can that can be implemented, but generally speaking, that is one path. The other is really just to say, well, if I use these models under known circumstances on training sets, I obtain this type of outputs I can understand. But in my mind, it would be more interesting to say, what happens if I provide a network and model that has never seen before and is capable of giving me an answer why that is different from the previous cases? So main point here is that if we can ask the models to do some type of minimum reasoning, not as the extent of a human expert, but at least to the point that a minimum reason that provides insights about data distributions or how data points are significantly different or close to in the context of a known data, that will be, in my mind, a step forward towards that.
I see. Yeah. I really like your first idea as in like, yeah, in loose terms, these ideas I went through on, but it made more sense as in boiling down an explainable output into specific symbols that radiologists or any domain people can understand. So having like a structure to a particular explanation that is boiled down to symbols. And yeah, that makes a lot of more sense. Yeah. Yeah. And the other, I think there is a counter argument where people say, I mean, I'm definitely on your side. I do agree to these, but a counter argument is people who have been a very pros for deep learning is they say we should rather be focusing on validation and verification of deep learning rather than focusing on interpretability and explainability of these methods because it's hard to boil down these huge models that are modeling nonlinear associations and having like a gradient-based backpropagation method is like it's like basically boiling down the whole magic of deep learning to like a very standard binary outputs. So there are these two counter arguments. Basically, the other person is saying we should rather focus on validation because that's how like if you see any traditional engineering methods, we develop a method that works and then we heavily invest ourselves on validation, verification, quality analysis, and all those things, right? To see where the system breaks and then we fix it. So do you think that should be our major focus or still we should be more also relying on interpretability or whatever we just mentioned?
I believe it should be a mix between both.
I see.
That would be my thinking. I guess by advancing interpretability is kind of one part of the equation. Yes, this is we require this in order to advance the methods, the state of the art. But also the same part, I guess, we require verification, right, and validation. Mm-hmm. That is in the context of deploying models and then, analyzing data at the large scale.
Yeah,
but this will provide, I guess, these two axes. One is from the strategic standpoint, advancing technology, and perhaps the other is more on the kind of execution path, technical, tactical path. Right. But at the end of the day, for me, it's kind of a combination of these two.
Makes sense. And one thing I also wanted to touch that we didn't get a chance is basically when we talked about adoption of these techniques, right? So I do also know that you started working before the big era of deep learning, right? Like before 2012 when things started to get really heated up in deep learning space. So and I was recently involved in doing a review study, right? So I see a lot of medical papers that have been using support vector machines and the basic machine learning techniques very confidently versus when it comes to deep learning, a lot of people, when you submit these papers, they don't, like the reviewers don't really understand the idea of deep learning because it's too much complex to understand and what's really going on. So I, as a very newbie and a new to this research, I do understand like people have much more confidence on these simple interpretable methods. Like if you throw logistic regression or support vector, or even I think decision trees at some point, they do really, they do on a very fairly regular basis. But how do you see the adoption of shallow learning versus deep learning? Like as in, when you throw these models, and I'm not sure how people have been using these transformer models, because that's like the new big thing. Like even I think not a lot of people in CS research understand how these transformers are replacing CNNs, or if at all they are doing that. So do you see the adoption patterns? Like when you were there, I think post 2012, do you see a very positive sentiment of these techniques being used, or is it still criticized or critiqued very harsh when we use in these interdisciplinary research?
I guess the short answer is yes, I see the adoption. And then mainly is because with these new technologies, and in particular with deep learning, we have solved problems that we were not, they were solvable, but I guess not at the magnitude that, or the accuracy that is done today. But perhaps, I guess, to put things in context, I will see this as kind of what DARPA calls the wave, the tier three waves of AI, and how we are evolving through those. So maybe to put it in perspective, is kind of the first wave is basically a rule-based, handcrafted rules. Second wave is about statistical inference, and that it really is along the lines of shallow learning with big data. So models are trained on the specific data sets with big data at large scale. The third component to this is kind of the third way of AI. But I guess to put in perspective, the way I see deep learning is between the edge of the 2D and the second wave, at the end of the 2 wave and the beginning on the third wave. So main point is that still we are deep learning models. They are still doing the statistical inference, right? We're estimating parameters at a number that was not imaginable before. But still, it's a statistical inference. So from there to ask the question, is this model has kind of a truly semantic meaning of that concept, that remains to be seen. I guess kind of in the context of the third wave, the idea is to say, if a second wave in shallow learning, deep learning, I say that I have the task of teaching my daughter what a dog, or what is the concept of a dog or a cat. According to the second wave, I will show thousands of pictures of a cat, and dogs will say, oh, you get it, right? Say, yes, I get it. In the third way, the concept, or I guess kind of the vision will be, I can show maybe 5 pictures of a cat, 5 pictures of a dog. Maybe I can draw a sketch of these two. And I can explain through words, through concept, to language, what that concept is. And then someone will say, oh, I get it. So I guess the point is that in the third way, perhaps we are focused more on reasoning, using prior knowledge, rather more on the semantic meaning, rather than in just kind of full statistical inference at that point.
Right.
But just to answer to this question, yes, so I see the adoption. But I guess also I see a progression in how this can be projected.
Right. But in the space of AI, do you think, like you did mention about you would want to see the third wave, right? Like where we are making sure the concepts are learned like how humans do. Do you think we are still at that phase of AI where, because as we see, like deep learning models still requires huge data sets to learn, right? Like the basic concepts versus, like you said, like if you showed a photo of infant, like even we can just see one photo of an animal and we can quickly identify like a similar animal and label them, versus it still takes a long time. We have seen a lot of failed cases. Do you think, this is much more related to AI specific question, but do you think we are at that phase of where we can boil down a concept of anything to an AI model and can learn in fairly small data samples?
Yes, absolutely. In specific cases, absolutely yes. But I guess the challenge here is to understand what does it take to generalize to more use cases. So I guess that progression-wise, that I see kind of a roadmap that we are making great steps towards that. But still, it remains to be proof, zero shot. Can I do it from one concept two concepts or from one specific domain to a totally new domain. Yeah. In the context of, for example, learning from natural images, learning from to medical images, can we achieve that? Or not just in that, I guess, a specific use case, but might be more on video analytics as well, right? Cases that are totally unseen. So I guess I'm thinking more on the latter.
Right. And yeah, talking about concepts, it also leads me to one more question, like, which I mean, since I'm on a similar track in research, I also wanted to know is there any evidence, like, if you have been working on many projects, like, do you have seen any instances where AI has contributed to some kind of discovery, as in something that researchers or medical professionals who have been doing their own set of techniques for analysis and all those things didn't figure it out, but deep learning was, or machine learning, I would say, machine learning broadly was able to find patterns that is significantly useful to progress this field. And one instance, I mean, everybody knows is DeepMind, right? Like they published the AlphaFold and it did a great amount of havoc that, hey, it solved a long lasting medical research problem. But that is, like, again, a very ambitious project that a lot of people worked on, but the whole different field. Have you seen any instances? And if you have any, like, can you share any instances so that people know that, yeah, this has some potential?
Yeah, absolutely. And in particular, I have worked maybe in one use case, at least, is in the context of molecular pathology. But okay. I guess here, kind of the idea to provide some context. So one of the main challenges today to understand how cancer operates at some level is to measure what is heterogeneity of cells, cancer or no cancer, in terms of genetic genes and conditions. So in the context of providing a breakthrough, say a personalized therapy for cancer treatments, the analytics need to make a measurement at the cell level, of very large, sections of tumor from the microscopic level, and understand model correlations different, gene expressions, and optimize a function or a criteria that might be derived from a drug treatment or survival. So I guess in the context of life sciences, molecular pathology, basic biology, basic cancer research, machine learning has been a success story in how we can derive better outcomes for patients in the context of leveraging these statistical models for large scale for driving and understanding molecular pathways that might optimize drug treatments.
I see. It's interesting. Yeah, there are a few instances, I think, even for projects that when, like, even though I knew what I was signing up for, only later when I was working on these projects, I realized the potential. And, like, it's not even just for the sake of fun. Like, I think there are some very nice analysis, like pseudo analysis, I would say, based on machine learning results. And I'll just for the sake of conversation, I'll share an example that my collaborators were working on. Is basically at Mayo Clinic, they are working on headache data. So we have migraines, concussions, post-traumatic headache. And the bad thing about, from a medical research standpoint, is there is a tremendous amount of lack of data. So it's hard to generalize any results. And the second thing is, like, they are not able to find any patterns using existing methods, as in, like, what symptoms or what brain regions are causing these issues. Because if they want to develop a treatment, they have to know, right, like, which brain regions are affected, and hence they can do these. And based on, and it's a huge data, it's a huge data, as in, like, it's a high dimensional data, because we have MRI scans. So it's hard to analyze. And yeah, they we are exploring these idea of AI, that can we localize regions that are specific to a disease phenotype. But like you said, most of these times, like, these classes are very heterogeneous. So it's like you have so many patterns, even just for, like, cancerous versus non-cancerous. And in our case, it's like basically healthy patients versus any kind of disease patients. So you'll see, you have a data set of 30 or maybe 40 individuals, but so many different types of migraines that it's hard to even build a classifier. So the applications are very, very motivating.
Correct, exactly. So it depends on the, I guess, use cases, heterogeneity. And maybe just to brainstorm about some other applications, text analytics. is a field that I would call it a success story. There's a very good example in my mind in how deep learning has been tremendously valuable in processing large amounts of data, conversational data, providing insights about sentiment analysis, but identifying entities, providing a complete analysis of semantic input into semantic input from non-structured data to structured, standardized data up to some degree.
Yeah, makes sense. Yeah, definitely. I cannot agree more to that. So yeah, definitely. And in terms of I do find a gap also at times when people who are publishing work from an academia with medical AI applications. Do you see there is something anything that's wrongly focused in academia for medical AI projects? Because I often see there are a great amount of publications who never make it to a real world use case. I mean, the ratio is definitely bigger. But in your experience, you were in academia previously, and now you are in industry. Do you find any kind of work specifically not useful, saying that now from an industry standpoint, if I publish something or do a certain kind of technique, you might as well say like, hey, great results, it's published, but it doesn't make it to the real world. This won't work because of XYZ reasons. Do you see any patterns, or do you have any insights that, hey, don't focus on these things. These are not real world scenarios.
Yeah, for me, it's hard to say or hard where to put the threshold. And for the main reason is that sometimes you came across a publication that might not be related to a specific interest. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean that it might not be relevant in the future. So I guess what I'm saying is one is a scientific rigor, the methodology, and then the other is on the end application or no application at all. But I guess what I'm saying, we don't know whether that might be relevant in the future for some other idea. So in that case, I take it with a salt of grain. Don't try to disregard, but rather just keep it as a backup or as an extra resource.
Yeah, makes sense. And in terms of real world scenario is how do you comment on these big models that are coming out, like the GPT-3 and all those things? Like, do you feel they would have industry application scenario where potentially companies, because it takes so many millions of dollars to train these models, and even testing phase, like people like academia won't be able to dabble with it. Like, I think it would be the industry experts who can do that. But do you see from a result standpoint, like even if all those computation costs put aside, do you see these big models are gonna stay here for like a potential application, or they would still remain in the academia to research and then maybe fine tune, and when something that's very engineeringly less weighted would be used in industry? Do you have any comments for big models?
Yeah, I guess my approach to big models is that it takes effort, financial effort and resources effort to come up with these models, to bring the data to train those models. And as far as kind of the use cases, this is where I will, maybe in my mind, I will be guided by ethics and asking the questions, from the ethics perspective, is where this model kind of makes sense to use, as far as we comply that boundary in my mind. To me, that will be kind of the best practices or use cases of models. In the future, with computer power growing every day, with the storage growing every day, in my mind, there will be a path that these models will be, developed by different groups or organizations or academia in the near or medium term, in the medium term. That's where I guess we will kind of try to understand. That's where if we have a good base and good understanding where we can apply those models with an ethics-based formulations, where they actually might lead into the future once, I guess, they are more predominantly adopted.
Makes sense. Yeah, definitely. I it makes much more sense, as in how do these, because I see these, like, I think I was reading, like, when GPT-3 came out and it made public to a lot of researchers to try out these models, I initially, like, being a very skeptical about it, like, I was like, what's the use case scenario? Like, this would be just a game, right? Like, just people who would be like to play and put in some words and it will generate out images. But I think I was reading on Twitter and one person mentioned, like, this would be a very quick proof of concept for people who are artists. So let's say you are an animator or something, like, let's say you want to project an idea to someone and you want to say, I don't know, Simpson sitting in a BMW, something like that. So it will take me one day or something as an artist to create that image for you, versus if I can do that in a few seconds, it will just expedite the process of creative people. And I was like, damn, I didn't catch that particular, because I have not seen those scenarios, right? Like, people who have experience might see that, hey, it can be used in endless scenarios. But again, it comes down to the weightage of, like, do like spending millions of dollars on training a model and the use case is like a quick proof of concept, would you still consider? And with all the, I think there is also this regulations on environment, right? Like, training these models, how much does it affect the environment and all those things. But I know it's an open-ended topic, so it's definitely interesting to learn thoughts.
Yeah, and then just kind of goes back, I guess, to the point that recently on DALL-E, correct, taking that as a use case, there was a contest about design and artistic design, and someone submitted a picture from DALL-E in the contest, and it turned out that it won the first place. So I guess this is kind of a recently on the media. To my best of my knowledge, is about 3 weeks old or something like that. But I guess this is kind of pointing to those number of use cases where we cross the boundary whether a human generated that data and how actually it can be used, and also the end use to that. On the resources to train those models, we are hoping that these are foundational models. With the right applications and the right use, then we can save resources and when we have to kind of generate a new task, rather than training 10 GPT-3s, can we train a foundational model? And we have a different number of applications, perhaps to medicine or detections or just generating art or something similar. Rather than training 10 GPT-3s, can we just spend a fraction of that and have 10 GPT-3s specialized? Yeah. So I guess that's where I see also how this can be playing out in the future.
Right.
And not only that, but the data sets, right? So ultimately, I guess the data sets wise, this is what might be kind of giving us those capabilities. Better data, better models. So another question here is, how can we also think about these data sets? Mm-hmm. How can we make them shareable? Or what is kind of unique and characteristic from that data set that led to such a good training model? Was domain knowledge that we use, or was the use of specific, insights, or was just kind of purely data driven? So that might be something else to consider.
I think that, like, I love that idea, and I want to extend that particular thing for medical scenarios. So we all know, like, this is a very known fact, as in lack of data sets is like a biggest roadblock for medical imaging applications. But of course, as a researcher, we don't try to treat them as roadblocks, and we try to work around. But what are the unknown insights that you have that goes into these kind of scenarios? Like, of course, people know that lack of data sets is causing issue. It's not that people deliberately are trying to hold onto data sets. But what are the challenges? Like, why do we have lack of data sets? Like, why do they arise? Like, in standard computer vision applications, we never complain about data sets. I mean, if we do generate data sets, so that not a lot of people complain about it. But working from our different standpoints, like, how do you have any insights? Like, what are these typical scenarios that cause these lack of data sets?
Yes, in my mind, there are different scenarios and the different root causes. One is interoperability. So having, I guess, in the medical domain, many different medical devices with different standards, different medical imaging modalities, different algorithms for producing the images, for calibrating the devices, this leads to a very heterogeneous data set. On top of that, I guess, if we add the regulations that make, on data privacy, that's another something to consider in how, and understand how we can share and access those data sets and what will be the implications of that as far as kind of data privacy. But I guess something that perhaps is being is still kind of in exploratory phase is to say, okay, well, medical imaging, data sets are somewhat relatively well constrained as opposed to natural images. So we know the variability, we know that a lung is not going to have a star shape, things like that. So I guess kind of this is kind of making the point and understanding into how we can generate models, I guess, from synthetic data, not entirely from real data. So I guess this is where we can say, well, we have some domain knowledge, we have some constraints that we can leverage and turn this into our favor. Can we use those to have kind of a new approach or different approaches? And how can we train models? We know that there is not sufficient data sets with real data, but can we generate some synthetic data? It doesn't have to be entirely realistic, it just has to be good enough for the models to learn. So I guess there are some other kind of viable paths that still kind of can be further improved, that still they are not quite mainstream up today.
I see. Makes sense. And I also want to connect back. I think one of the points that intrigued me a question was, I think you talked about Dolly. So, and not related to that, but like there was at least a scenario in every researcher's life when they saw deepfakes, right? So deepfake videos and all those things, and everybody got concerned. Even the people who are working on AI, they understand the model. It's not dangerous. But when we saw deepfakes and in applications, it's scared. Do you overall feel scared about the application of AI? Since you're working on medical imaging projects, do you, as a researcher, even though we know how these models work, they are not miracles, they are just a mathematical big function, but do you feel scared about the application of AI and misusing it in any kind of potential way that we as an engineers might not have considered?
Yeah, absolutely. So I am concerned. I'm concerned every day.
Yeah.
So I guess sometimes there is a misconception that deep learning, so this I guess AI based models are bulletproof, or they can be used for in many different contexts. But I guess it's important to be aware of the limitations and the use cases. On the deep fakes, I guess I'm concerned. But if I go back on my list of what things I should be concerned of, I guess one of the tops on top of my mind is about how fragile these networks are at the end of the day. Yeah. In the sense that yes, you can train a model, can get you 100% accuracy, can be extremely reliable, but what happens when from the moment you start kind of maybe just changing slightly the pixels, manipulating the image in such a way that for a human the change is imperceptible, but this is entirely throwing off the model. So I guess kind of my one of the main concerns to me is, like, at the end of the day, how these architectures, how fragile, how brittle they can be, at very small changes that for a human will be no intended affected.
Yeah,
and perhaps this kind of goes back also to the point of kind of the second wave of AI and the third wave of AI. If these models will involve reasoning, I guess at the higher, more on the semantic and semantic meaning, then we will hope that they will be less prone to those.
Yeah, And I think this also ties to the question that we discussed is like the adoption, right? I think these kind of scenarios mm-hmm. make it much more like people who are deploying these models, these definitely go against that. Like if these kind of perturbations in the input data can throw off the predictions, then we don't really trust, because real world data is not going to be pure and processed, right? So, but since you have been working on this, like how do you think, we need to have like a methodological innovation or an like an architectural innovation in order to improve these methods? Or yep. should it be just a post hoc verification process, right? Like where I have strict processes of just eliminating that, hey, it didn't work in these scenarios and hence this architecture is not working. Or do you think we still need some innovations?
Yeah, I believe we still need a lot of innovations. In my mind, we require a lot of innovations. And I guess from a practical standpoint or from a technical standpoint, they might be coupled, I guess, to the core, I guess, architecture. But if innovation occurs at the moment of ingesting data and detecting this type of data points that are anomalous, that will be a huge win. Not only because of that, but also because it might be provide insights about data quality. Most yeah. of the, I guess, failure cases is not just because models are bad, but it's because just the data quality or the input signal is subtle, something completely off. But I guess what I'm saying, so in my mind, yes, so we require a lot of innovations. This is almost like an arm race. New tamperous methods are coming up every day. Cybersecurity is a concern. And if we are going to be deploying these models at the large scale, then we have to have this failure. We have these safe systems in place.
Yeah,
and not only detection, but also in how to programmatically how to understand how we can make algorithms, workflows immune to those cases.
Yeah, I agree, and I mean as a researcher new in this field, I feel this is like a good news, right? Like at least I have something that I can work on, and like it's not definitely a saturated field, because it's very hard. Like I don't know how it resonates with you also, but just the space of AI and deep learning, let alone not just the pure deep learning, but AI and deep learning, you feel so much saturated. Like people are publishing so much stuff. At times, I feel like, do I even have a novel idea that I can work on? Because if I come up with an idea that, hey, I want to do that, I search that and I'll see some archive paper that has already tried doing that in a very nice sense. So it always feels like the field is saturated. But I think there was like a sinusoidal time in my life when I started. I felt like, oh, hey, applications of AI and deep learning, I don't find many people working on it, and hence I'll make an impact. And I started reading papers and I feel like, oh, this field is so much saturated. I feel like I don't have a chance for contributing. And then now I feel, oh, all of these models that are so fragile, like you said, like these techniques are so fragile, not that they are bad, but like we just need so much of iterations of these, like we need multiple people to improve based on these published results. So yeah, but I want to know, like do you feel compared to other disciplines, does this field receive an enormous amount of submissions and people publishing stuff with easy access to GPUs nowadays? So I think a tweet that mentioned like all you need is a GPU. So like do you agree to that, or do you still are you still optimistic with the idea that, hey, we still need more submissions?
I will think we need more submissions. Okay. And I partially disagree in the good sense with only GPU
yeah.
access, because it's data access.
Yeah.
And nowadays, I guess the access-wise to public data sets is tremendous. Anyone can access, download data from different, specific domains and applications. Everyone, processing power is becoming a commodity. So I guess these two components are just enabling, innovation. And the number of idea of applications that are coming up day to day. Yeah. If I look at my, at the Twitter feeds about new papers, I cannot keep up.
yeah.
But also it kind of makes me think if we try to understand what the failure case is, what are the limitations, what are the risks of these technologies, then this really opening, I guess, from the flip side, the door of saying what are kind of the new directions that we might actually follow, what are the technical gaps that need to be addressed.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, and also I think, it's definitely, we won't be, reviewing all of them, but as in, at some point, we also do realize like some of the, like as you read more and more papers, you realize some of the papers don't really add up to the standard of like a research. But nowadays, since the applications are so much, we tend to publish, and it's an overhead for people who are reviewing. I think my other advisor was like a reviewer for CVPR for many years, and this year he gave up because it's like he said like it's too much, like it's hard to take on. And the even from a submission, like a person who is submitting to CVPR, I have known like a lot of students who are like at the age of me who are reviewing, and I mean I do like to review, but it's like definitely a very bad case scenario for a submitter, like because if I don't have the experience of this field, how do I review? How do I make sure that my reviews are gonna add on to that particular author's list?
I am on the same page. So sometimes I'm kind of kidding that people should come up with a new competition about taking all the previous, I guess, submissions from CVPR or a conference and training models about what papers were accepted and not. And whether I guess can kind of generate the recommendations, but I guess that will be kind of something, I guess beyond joke, I guess the joke. I totally hear you. Just there are so many things coming up. It's very hard to keep up. And I guess quality wise is very extremely heterogeneous.
And I want to ask one more open-ended question before we go on to the other questions is a lot of like I think many past researches, like if you see MRI, I think I forgot, like was it MRI or X-ray, I think that was developed with a different intention, like it was never invented with the invention of analyzing body, but I think it was some physics related research that people came up, and then later someone working in medical research took on that particular thing, and I think MRI became like the biggest standard, right? Like there's nothing better in terms of analyzing human biology. But like these are the scenarios where you see interdisciplinary research getting inspiration into other researches. Working in bio research, like I think you're working at the cross section, you are trying to improve two particular fields and come to a conclusion. Do you feel working on these projects, they have induction into CS research, as in can we get inspired by these problems and focus on using that as an inspiration to optimize for algorithmic novelty? Do you ever see that, or is it hard to find that in medical research problems?
Absolutely. In my mind, it's easy to see it and easy to find it. There are different examples, but I guess this is kind of asking a similar question about applying science and just pure science, right? Or pure math or applied math. And question is whether applied problems can also push new theoretical boundaries on theory and kind of put it back as far as can the methods. My thought is that new microscopes, instruments are generating more data every day, but I guess more data in the context of more resolutions, more insight, and at a scale that we have never seen before. So this is really kind of pushing the limits of what are capable today as far as theoretical tools and algorithms to analyze data. So in my mind, I'm kind of hoping that in the next few years there will be a major breakthroughs on methods that will have to be developed specifically to address some of these problems. One of the examples is cancer-based research. Assuming that then we can have access to billions of cells in a tumor cancer from many, many, many patients, the question will be, what will, with the tools that we have today, can we solve that problem? Or do we need to think about new technologies, new algorithms, new methods to address those specific challenges? I'm hoping that will be the case.
Right. And I think feel free to add more info. I think we did discuss about your contributions and your interest on working in the molecular pathology for cancer. But in terms of layman sense, and also like feel free to dive deep, how does the AI research that you see is being used? And as in like, what are like, if you see from a completely non-technical standpoint, where are we at? As in what is the progress being done in medical research? What are the challenges? And where does AI fit into the bigger picture of these research? Like, is it more like just a play tool for people that, hey, we worked on this, let's try out if AI can do this? Or is it like something considered as a very integral part of these analysis? So can you give us a context of what the non-technical background looks like, and how does AI fit into that domain?
Yeah, so I guess there are different examples on how the AI actually can fit in the different domains. Perhaps I can provide insights on two examples. So say sure. on pathology, now the digitalizations of pathology, now this is creating a number of needs and requirements for algorithms and analysis. But I guess my point is that the immediate use case there is on automation, in automation of steps that before were extremely manual. Nowadays, with the use of AI, we can do understand the question about quality of image, quality of data, and provide initial clues for downstream analysis for people so that they can be more, they can increase the productivity. That perhaps at the high level, that is on maybe on pathology. In radiology, is a similar story. Nowadays, I guess we can ingest lots of data, but I guess we can provide clues to radiologists about diseases. And pathologies, and can provide at some extent what might be the explanation to that pathology. So that might be, I guess, another use case. Beyond that, there are also a different number of granular use cases.
I see. Makes sense. Yeah. I always like one of my brother who works on, I think he works on breast cancer research, but he comes from a completely medical standpoint. So he, when we talk, it's more like he's much more intrigued into the idea of using AI or data science. So he's trying his hands on for Python and basic programming. So he always asks me, how can I do that? Because that's the next big thing for him to write in grants. And me, on the other hand, is normally asking questions, because I find cancer research, I don't directly work on this, but I find like that to be like a very immediate low-hanging fruit for using AI into this research. Yep. Because it's like very, very useful. We have data, we have a good amount of public data sets, so it's an interesting field.
Yes, and then perhaps the most meaningful impact on AI is on the single cell analysis. So okay. for the reason is that we have access to the pathology data sets. Typically, I guess, to the automated workflows I was kind of alluding to is, at the image level, right? Mm-hmm. But understanding and doing an analysis at the cell level is tremendous laborious that a human cannot actually do it. So in a data sample, we may have hundreds of thousands of cells. And each cell might be unique as far as an individual, right? If we map back, I guess, all the protein content of that cell, that might be leading to a very specific bioprofile at the cell level. And even more, if we are able to quantify that for every cell, the nucleus, membrane, and cytoplasm, and ask the question, what are the genes that are mostly expressed in these different cell compartments? And if I take a look back now and I look at this at the whole tumor level, can I ask the question, what is the expression of this cancer? What is it unique? How is it responding to specific treatments? Now, if I take another step back and I look at this at the cohort level for 100 patients of medical trial, And I asked the same question, I guess that's where the power of these analytical tools might be most, I guess, meaningful.
I guess
providing the measurement analytical tools that humans cannot, execute because of the complexity. Similarly in the potential in the radiology, the very large scale models.
I think that's a wonderful explanation because it was funny. I think a few weeks back I was talking to my parents and they still don't understand what I exactly work on. They just know I'm doing a PhD, and when I tell them I'm working on medical imaging projects, so they always ask me this one question: you being an engineer, why are you working on medical research problems? You are not signed up for a medical professionals, because they still don't understand the idea of how AI can be potentially used into these research projects. So it's a wonderful, like, I think how you put it at the end was really nice, that models or computer-based applications can process these granularities much better. Humans are not built for doing that. We can understand things and work on concept level, but when we are looking very granular and things that we don't even know what to look for, I think that's very useful. And I think one more instance that I can share to that is basically it was only, I think, more than 2 years I started working on MRI scans, and I always wondered, like, if the doctor's results are so much confident, why don't we just hire more radiologists to scan these MRI scans, right? Like, that would solve the issue. Why are we working on from AI level? But I think when I actually met a person who was analyzing this MRI scan, I actually knew what are the struggles of actually diagnosing an MRI scan. It's not very easy. It's like very hard to do that. It's not a one day, 1 hour process. It takes a lot of amount of experience, a lot of amount of time. And I think that's when I learned that, hey, these are the costs, and automation is what you suggested, right? Like, so even having a 90% confident result will have a significant amount of help on the screening process, or the applications could be endless. So yeah, thanks for that. But again, I want to zoom out and get out of this medical AI domain and ask you more questions as you being a researcher, and I focus on you. Is the first and the hardest question that one might ask is, should I get a PhD? I want to be the industry. I want to be in, I'm from computer science. Should I be doing a PhD in order to work on research projects? As in the same manner as you and your teammates are working on. So in order to make the same contributions, should I get a PhD in 2022?
Yeah. Yeah. So I guess when I am asked that question, my answer is another question. It's slightly poses slightly different.
Yeah.
But I guess I will try to rephrase the question on asking, why should I not do a PhD?
Okay. Okay.
So I guess might be a slightly different way, but I guess I'll try to approach it in that way.
Yeah.
And I guess you have very strong reasons of why not doing a PhD might be in the sense like, well, I don't really like the research. Well, it might be that I like the research, but I'm not committed, or I don't have the flexibility at this point in my time, my life, and my career to dedicate for a PhD. And there might be others. Mm-hmm. I guess my recommendation is, like, if you don't find a very strong reason of why not, then you should ask, why not do it?
Yeah, makes sense. I think the incentives for doing a PhD are as minimal as possible. So I think unless you are specifically motivated and 100% sure, and I think, like, the brother I was mentioning, I took his recommendation for doing a PhD. He also did his PhD actually University of Houston, so he's actually staying in Houston. So I'm it's a common ground between you two. But he said, like, just make sure that you are 150% sure of doing a PhD, and then only do it, because the incentives to stay over there is minimal.
Exactly. Okay. And just to complement that question, I guess the follow-up question might be, why should I do the PhD?
Yeah.
And I guess the primary metric, I guess, for me will be, is this something that I really like? Is this something that I am really extremely passionate about?
Yeah.
That I'm willing to take a chance. I don't know whether I will have success. Hopefully that's the case. But I will not know if I don't try it.
Yeah, but let me rephrase the question, and maybe like what we can talk is, as in, would PhD give anyone a significant advantage that you wouldn't have learned any other way, that is helping you in your current job duties, that you would say that this can only be done using these particular scenarios? For example, you won't like, it's hard to have the same amount of coding experience from, like, let's say a person who is not from technical background, who hasn't gone through the rigorous process of like submissions or like the coursework process that goes into a computer science curriculum. The other person might not have that much rigor in coding, and coding in a very constrained development cycle. So do you think the PhD course allows you or helps you learn certain things that won't be replaceable through other means that you think are useful in your current job role?
In my mind, it will be extremely difficult. And I guess not difficult, I will say. It might really depend on the type of, program or task that someone is involved. But I guess the nowadays, I guess if we take that idea and we ask in the context of analytics and data science, I will say the skills that are developed, I guess, by scientists today are really quite democratized. Why? Yeah. Because everyone has access to, number one, data, the most important commodity. Everyone has access to computers. And guess what? There are many projects in GitHub and in the internet that we can use. So someone that is self-motivated, that has a passion about data science, can actually use these resources to achieve similar goals. The perhaps kind of the advantage of the PhD is that you go over a technical training. You have expectations as far as number of publications and accomplishments, and it's giving you kind of a formal training and topics, with advantage that you will have an advisor, a professor that is going to be guiding you through that topic and be leading you to solve that specific challenge. But I guess what I'm saying is, it is feasible, but it depends on the type of specific path.
Yeah, and just to add on to that, I think one of the key things that I learned, so again, a misconception that I had before I got enrolled into PhD, and like this was like, I got enrolled into COVID time, so I met my professor almost 1 year later. So it was hard to have those informal conversations where you're talking anything but project, right? So like those conversations really help you as in understanding what are your goals from PhD, right? Like, why did I do that? And it was only later that I learned like CS PhD has almost least things to do with your coding and your programming skills. It is much more about your research skills. And it took me like a very long time to understand these two differences, right? Like I thought like me being a good programmer is gonna help me get to my 80% of my PhD, and 20% would be, yes, I'll be publishing papers and the other like drama that we have to do for in order to get a graduate degree. But it was completely different. Like, I think programming skills are like the least important. I'm not going to downplay programming. It definitely helps. But building a research skill is really useful. And so citing back to other experiences, and recently the Amazon one, like I could see that difference, as in, unless a person has not done a PhD, it's very hard for, it's not impossible, it's really hard for the other person to connect and get on board and deliver results very fast, because they might not have the background. So I agree to whatever you said, and just a second pointer that I thought, like, okay, yeah, this is why I think companies have a mandatory requirement for PhD degree when they look for, like, I think research scientist roles or something, and it makes sense now. But when I was in my master's, I felt like, oh, why can't I apply for research scientist? I have the knowledge, I have the experience, please hire me. But I think these are the experiences.
And then just maybe a note on that, I guess, for hiring, that's a criteria, but not is compulsory. So there are candidates that might not have a PhD, they have a great research experience, and I guess that is having a PhD is useful, but there are also other merits.
Yeah, true, definitely. And that brings me with like maybe one of the few last questions is, do you have any advice for people who are into AI research, be it like there doesn't have to be in research or specific PhD program, but what kind of things that you would recommend people to focus on? Because the reason I ask this question, even though it's very redundant, is we have ample amount of information, right? Ample amount of spaces to go to. Like, do I focus on, let's say, I don't know, diffusion models, GAN models, or synthesis, classification, computer vision, language processing, and there are, I'm sure I'm missing, like, I think robot planning and all those things. And all of them are very interesting for people who are in research of AI, right? Because they all involve similar kind of techniques at the end, different modalities. But it's a, the basic question is, like, it's very hard to get distracted by so many applications and at the end not be working on any. So how would you recommend people who are, how would you advise a person who is newly interested in AI? How should he or she navigate his career or her career?
Yeah, maybe my advice will be for someone starting a career on AI is pick a topic, pick something that people are passionate, maybe applications for computer vision, maybe language or speech recognition. And now, main point is pick something that you will feel passionate and you will feel great spending the time. Second is that read papers. Read papers, many papers as possible. And while reading these papers, then people will start training, will start learning to differentiate papers' qualities and different objectives, and they start also developing a skill, right, on reading a paper. Second is that identify an area that might be that you actually feel strongly about it, or something that you would like to start if it doesn't exist, and really go deeply technical on that. Main point is that applications wise, there are many opportunities, there are many public data sets, there are many areas. But if someone identifies a specific area and go deep in a technical aspect on the mathematical formulations, on what, and understanding the technical challenges on implementing those solutions, maybe a pretty large scale, right?
Yeah,
that might be setting an initial path into navigating that career.
Yeah. And I think you also did mention about reading papers, and I'm just throwing out this question is, do you have any best practice for reading a paper? I think you have been writing a lot, and that I think one of the things I think my professor mentioned was like writing a paper will change the way how you read a paper. So what has been the best practice for you to read a paper? If if you were to skim read a paper versus really deep dive, what are the key points that you see in a paper so that you can, first of all, also learn what the paper is doing, and also hopefully criticize, saying that no, maybe this is wrong or this is not how it's done. Like, what are the key stencil that you would recommend anyone to see? What's your best practice?
My best practice is to look at the merit of the paper. Really, mainly from the is either kind of a new application that's kind of very useful, but also understanding whether there is kind of a new method. And then maybe saying, okay, so this conceptually is new, but then, and I guess the next question will be: can we just kind of strip that application? We can strip the method, understand what is kind of the fundamental principle behind that, how generalizable it is, how applicable are to new situations. That might be, I guess, one of the main criteria I use. Other is also how validations, how people are demonstrating feasibilities on this. They might be on data sets that are extremely that have been overanalyzed, if you will, or there are data sets that are kind of really kind of more challenging than the average. That was kind of one of the main criteria. But I guess going back to our points before, there are many methods that are published. Today it's difficult to pick and choose many. But I guess at the very least, I guess there are some guidelines, criteria, how people can go through, I guess, pick a few, read them whenever it's possible. And then there is a difference, right, from reading the paper to actually understanding all the technical details. As a best practice, I recommend pick a paper that you like the best, and then hopefully that's the case. Most likely the code is going to be in a repository. So you download the code, download the public data set, and you debug the code. That is kind of tremendously valuable. That is kind of giving you into all the kind of nuts and bolts on how these things actually work. And then the main point is like understanding those basic principles, then making analogies to some other papers, some other applications is becoming more natural. Yeah. So that might be helpful in maybe how to approach different, I guess, technologies, algorithms, applications nowadays.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, yeah, these are useful insights. And I mean, I'm still stuck at the one that I really like the most is basically how you said is like you analyze the approach and you see how much it is generalizable to other applications or is it just working on these particular data sets or scenarios? I mean, yeah, I love that. I've never like thought on these things in those senses, but yeah, it could be a thing how reviewers approach these scenarios. So yeah, thanks for sharing that. But yeah, I think these are the questions that I think I had for you. So yeah, I think we are at the end of podcast. So thanks. I think thanks a lot for doing this. I think we covered from a lot of different topics from your background to the role, understanding the role of a principal scientist to understanding the space of medical AI and also hopefully research. So thanks a lot for doing this. I know it's a Friday, so definitely thanks for
thank you, Jay.
Log up your afternoon on a Sunday, Friday. So yeah, I appreciate that.
A pleasure to be in the podcast, and thank you very much.